Welcome to Healthcare Du Jour, where we dish up and digest the latest in healthcare. For the next 30 minutes, sit back as we bring you insight, commentary, and discussion on trending topics to the table, all expertly served up by our host and his guests. Healthcare Du Jour is brought to you by Carium, the telehealth platform enabling healthcare's digital transformation, helping you care for people within the fabric of their daily lives. Now here's your host, Matt Fisher.
Welcome back, and thank you for joining as we dive into the hottest topics in healthcare. I'm your host, Matt Fisher. On the menu today is Tony Lemo, CEO at BioDot. Welcome, Tony.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
Doing very well. It's great to have you on the show today. And Tony, what I always like to do before getting into the main part of my conversation is to let my guests provide a little bit more of an introduction in terms of who they are and what they do. So the floor is yours.
All right. Well, thanks. So BioDot is the world's leading provider of systems for point-of-care diagnostics marketplace for manufacturing of tests in particular. We've been in business for almost 27 years now, providing our systems and services to the world's leading IVD manufacturers and life science companies. And I've been with the company since 2006 and now CEO. My background is actually in chemistry, analytical chemistry to be specific, so more of an instrumentation background, and that's come in real handy over the years at BioDot.
So kind of what first brought you into the healthcare industry, coming from that chemistry background?
My first job out of graduate school was actually at a pharmaceutical company, Glaxo, before they became GSK. So I was working in an analytical sciences lab, and then I transitioned into a very exciting drug discovery R&D group. And I just, you know, decided that that was where I felt like I had the biggest chance to make an impact. It was in the R&D side of the business, and I liked the pharmaceutical, you know, industry, and that was a good landing spot for me. And then not too long after that, we were developing some very interesting ways of doing high throughput drug discovery. And those interesting ways got noticed by people outside of Glaxo. And so I decided to leave and start up a business with a person who was the founder of BioDot. So my first interaction with BioDot actually began in 1996. Left and decided to become a small business entrepreneur, and I guess the rest is history. So,
yeah, and you said, you know, kind of now that you're focused on diagnostic testing. So, could you actually provide a little bit more of a description in terms of what that kind of covers, and you know how that fits into the overall system? Because it's, you know, obviously it's something that's become a bit of a popular topic, given all the testing discussions and complications and challenges that have arisen around COVID.
Yeah, sure. So BioDot provides equipment to the developers and manufacturers of rapid diagnostic tests. That's the primary market that we serve. We also serve other markets related to healthcare in clinical diagnostics, molecular diagnostics, and life sciences. But with respect to the point of care rapid diagnostics market, people buy our equipment to develop their tests, for starters. They also will buy our equipment if they've already got a test developed and they need to scale it to manufacturing levels. So we provide benchtop systems for R&D and low volume production, and all the way up into large scale production systems that are capable of making, you know, hundreds of millions of diagnostic tests per year. So we're really the go-to provider for people when it comes to producing their tests at scale. And we've been, you know, supporting this industry, as I said, for almost 27 years. So we're, you know, we're well connected to all the world's leading manufacturers of these tests on a global basis.
So, and when you're talking about the production of diagnostic tests, kind of what's the, you know, for lack of a better way to say it, the nuts and bolts process of developing and then scaling out a new test?
Yeah. So, you know, from the development perspective, there's obviously a lot that goes into the assay design from a reagent perspective, chemistry perspective, molecular biology perspective. That's not really, you know, our expertise, but that clearly resides within the developer companies themselves. They understand the required parameters for developing a test that would be usable in a rapid format. Where we come into play is providing the dispensing capability. So these reagents, whether they be antibodies or antigens, reagents of interest, have to be deposited onto the materials for these tests. And the typical material for these tests is nitrocellulose membrane in this sort of lateral flow format that people are familiar with today. So the reagents have to be deposited in very small quantities in very specific locations onto the nitrocellulose membrane. And that's what our equipment has been designed for since the beginning of our business. That's been our core competency, is ultra low volume dispensing and ultra precise and accurate locating ability for where those reagents are deposited.
And you're just talking about reagents and you know, how that's part of the testing process. Can you actually be able to just describe or define what a reagent is? Because I suspect not many people might know what that specifically is.
Yeah, the typical reagent, when we use that word in these types of tests, is some sort of capture antibody. It's a molecule that's been identified as being able to specifically bind to the analyte of interest. So, you know, in the case of like a COVID, it's designed to match up or bind with some portion of the spike protein is the typical one that's used. So it's designed to bind to that, and it also has what's called a conjugated material associated with it, so that it turns color. It in some way identifies itself as having been captured when it captures that material. So it's either a color change or something that, you know, that triggers a reader if it's a reader-based test. So it's specific to the target of interest. If it was, if it was flu, it would be something designed to specifically target the flu. If it's strep throat, it would be designed to specifically target streptococcus. So it really depends on the test. If it's pregnancy, it's, you know, looking for HCG. So it just depends on what the test is. But there's something that's specifically designed, and then it's bound to the membrane through a deposition process with a system that Biodot would sell. And then your sample is introduced, and as the sample makes its way up the test, it will bind to that test line based on that capture antibody. And now you have a signal that can be detected either visually, or optically through a reader.
So in kind of, how is the development process? And is it something where you have to create the reagent, or, you know, kind of what's that? How do you know when you have the right reagent for the particular, target that you're looking for, or I think you said protein that you're trying to bind?
Yeah. So the developers have some understanding of what those targets look like, and they will go through a series of research studies to try to identify the most specific form of an antibody that can bind. And then you typically have to isolate that specific form and have it manufactured at a large scale as a what's called a monoclonal antibody. So it's actually grown up cellularly, and it's designed to be very specific and sensitive to that particular analyte. So they'll go through a series of experiments to find that out on their side. They have some knowledge of the target and what might be a suitable property to bind, very strongly and specifically to that target. And that's really the expertise of the developers. That's where, their knowledge of molecular biology comes into play, and that's really their domain expertise.
How quickly does it typically take to develop a new reagent to drive the testing? Because it's, I'm just thinking with COVID as the most recent example. It appeared like testing was able to be developed relatively quickly. So was that on a faster than usual timeline, or was that kind of?
It was faster than usual. What happened with, so to answer your question initially, it probably takes 6 months, maybe longer, to get a test developed in a normal circumstance. Again, that's a broad range. It might be faster for some diseases that are better understood. It might take longer for something that's more novel. COVID was a little interesting because it was based on SARS primarily. And because of the impact that COVID was having on the world, there was rapid sequencing. So the whole, SARS-CoV-2 was sequenced, and the sequence domain information was published broadly on a global basis. So people had an opportunity to, and the scientific community had a chance to really understand how to develop something faster, because the whole sequence was made known quickly. And that allowed people to target certain regions of the SARS-CoV-2 and probe it in such a way that they could make a more specific, test on a rapid time scale. And so, yes, it was much faster than normal.
So was that kind of broad public sharing of the sequencing atypical for the industry?
I'm, that's not my area of expertise, but my understanding is yes, that's more atypical. you know, it's typically something that, you know, is a little bit more protected in many instances, particularly for some of the more novel diseases. But I think there's still pretty good open communication in the scientific community in general, in the testing world.
Kind of circling also back to a lot of what you're talking about, which is, you know, that this is kind of point of care rapid testing.
Right.
So what does that actually mean? You know, kind of, and what are the, and how does that differ from other types of tests that can be run?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, the rapid testing name generally is attributable to tests that can be performed in 15 minutes or less. That's the generally accepted definition of rapid. I think some people stretch that a little bit, but that's the generally accepted definition. And, you know, that compares and contrasts to laboratory-based tests, which the classic one for COVID comparison, as I'm sure you're aware, is the PCR test, which is a laboratory-based test that takes typically several hours to perform the assay because there's an instrument-controlled thermocycling process that has to occur to amplify the virus that's present to the point where it's able to be detected. And that takes special equipment, usually done in centralized testing facilities.
So for the lab testing, you just said PCR, which I know has been thrown around a lot, as you said, for COVID. Would you mind just kind of explaining what that is to make sure that everyone fully understands?
Yeah, so PCR is based on an amplification technique where a virus, for example, is present in a sample, and through a series of reagents, again, that are added, that the molecule is identified and then replicated or amplified. So you can have a very small amount, you know, maybe as small as a single strand of viral material that can then be amplified to you know, tens of thousands to millions of counts. And therefore be able to be detected. And that's a process that's been around for a long time in molecular biology, polymerase chain reaction, PCR. It's an amplification, an isolation and amplification process. And so it makes the test very sensitive, sensitive.
Yeah, and kind of what you just said in terms of, you know, making it more sensitive was going to go to my next question, which is, I feel like I've heard a lot in the news that the PCR, the lab testing, is more accurate. And it sounds like that might just be based upon the fact that it's getting more granular into the sample that was collected.
It has a higher sensitivity, or another way to describe it is it's got a lower limit of detection. So it can detect, you know, a single strand or a small number of strands. Whereas with an antigen test that you hear about in the rapid format, you might need tens of thousands of viral particles to be able to be detected, just based on the fact that there's, you know, limited sample prep, and of course there's no amplification present. So the good news about PCR is it can detect very, very small loads, viral load. The problem that people have with PCR when they talk about it is it doesn't necessarily tell you whether you're actually actively able to infect somebody. You can test positive by PCR weeks after you've actually initially contacted a virus, in this case, you know, COVID. So there is that challenge that it tells you that you have viral particles in your body, but that you're not necessarily able to spread those. Whereas an antigen test, it, you know, if it detects viral particles, it's almost certainly detecting them at a point in time when you are actively able to transmit. So that's why there seems to be almost two camps that have developed, the rapid test camp and the PCR camp. And the rapid test camp is arguing that the value is you can detect people while they're actively able to do most harm and spread. Whereas PCR, that's not always the case. You may have, you know, people who are positive but are actually not a threat to spread the virus. So antigen tests, rapid tests could be used to capture these potential spreaders early and allow them to take protective measures such as, you know, quarantining and things like that. So
yeah, no, that's a very interesting distinction. And kind of, as you said, the fact that with the PCR testing, the positivity rate can be detected for a longer period of time. You know,
right.
You know, I know, like, my wife is a physician, so I've heard her, you know, she's told me it's like, you know, she's had patients who have been positive, gone through their whole course, and then it still shows up weeks or even months afterwards just because the virus happens to linger in the system. But as you said, that doesn't necessarily mean it's still infectious.
Correct. That's right. And so that's, you know, there can be some, you know, misleading characteristics from that perspective, from the, you know, population's concerned. So, and you know, PCR is a great test, but you cannot perform it on a large scale cost effectively, right? That's the other challenge. It certainly is a, you know, all things being equal, it's a more sensitive test, as we said, but it's just not practically scalable to populations, whether the populations be, you know, students at a university, whether the population, you know, is a local, you know, area in a community, whether the population is an entire country. You know, you certainly can't scale PCR. The preparation time, the instrumentation required is just not suitable for that. Whereas antigen tests, rapid tests in the format that are used today, also have the major advantage of being scalable. The cost is sufficiently low that they can be broadly distributed. In fact, as you're probably seeing now, they can actually be administered at home without the assistance of a physician. So that opens up a lot of opportunities that are significant in providing better access to diagnostic testing from a healthcare perspective, which is, I think, is the attractive aspect of these, you know, so-called rapid tests is that aspect, the broad distribution and potentially at-home use.
Yeah, no, I think those are very good points. And for those of you just joining, I'm talking with Tony Lemo from BioDot, talking about diagnostic testing and kind of some of the things we've learned through COVID. And kind of with that idea, you know, were there particular challenges or opportunities that were seen as a result of COVID that can be used to help, from your perspective, future kind of evolution of diagnostic testing or preparedness for kind of the next healthcare event?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, there's two major areas that I think will have several benefits beyond COVID. The first is the innovation that took place in the industry from a development perspective, from a test format perspective in the face of the COVID crisis was significant. The industry had always been talking about, you know, being able to have, you know, for example, reader-based assays or assays that could be assisted with the use of a smartphone apps. Because that's, you know, that's something that everyone, you know, broadly speaking, everyone is familiar with now is an app ecosystem, right? We're all used to going to our smartphones to get information. And so the ability to have a smartphone provide direction to someone on how to take a test is important. You know, you could actually click through on a wizard, you know, format, and it'll tell you how to actually administer the test. That's a huge advantage to the end user to be able to have a test that can do that, because that's one of the concerns that has always been raised about broadly distributing these types of tests, you know, from beyond a physician's control, is how do you get people to A, provide symptomatic information? Did I have a fever? Was I in contact with someone who might have had this? You know, that sort of background epidemiological information is really critical. It's actually essential in the case of COVID. So how do you enable people to capture that information so the healthcare industry knows that? Well, you can do that with an app, and that's where the smartphone app ecosystem is helpful. You know, the second part is having what I would call more reader-based assays, where the user is not required to interpret the result directly, but there's an interpretation made for them. That could be from a reader that's actually detecting the signal on the test, and it's using its own built-in algorithms to basically tell the user that they, you know, that they have either a positive or negative result. And that information can also directly communicate, typically by Bluetooth, back to a healthcare provider or to the healthcare community at large. In the case of COVID, you know, epidemiological information can be gathered. Those are huge advances that have taken place that will really open the door for things beyond COVID. You can easily imagine flu being the same in the same kind of format. Anyone who has, you know, ever had kids and wondered whether their child who has a fever has the flu or not would love to be able to have a flu test and be able to determine whether it's the flu or whether it's the quote common cold. And now you can throw COVID into the mix. Is it COVID? Is it flu? Is it strep throat? Is it something else? Well, if you have access to tests at home, you know, as an example, that really allows people to have confidence in their ability to, you know, take care of their own healthcare. It also provides physicians with differential diagnosis capabilities. You know, telemedicine has really become prominent as a result of COVID, which is another related area. And if you're a physician asking someone to describe their symptoms, wouldn't it be great to say, okay, I want you to take a flu test, a COVID test, and some other test, a pneumonia test, and tell me whether, you know, we'll find out what the results are. So you don't have to go to the physician to get a test. The test can come to you. They can order the test, or they can be picked up at a pharmacy. And now you can actually administer healthcare remotely in a very effective way. So those are huge advances that COVID has really ushered in. And, you know, there's permission space now regulatory-wise to allow that on a broader scale. I think you've probably seen some at-home tests have now been authorized. And that's a big step forward for broader access to diagnostics and healthcare for the patient population.
Yeah, and kind of that, as you said, the development and rollout of that at-home capability certainly seems to align with a lot of the other components of the healthcare industry, where it's trying to get more, I hate to say direct to consumer, because it's still, as you said, tying into the rest of the healthcare ecosystem, but, you know, more meeting the patient where they are and allowing for, I think, as you said, the expansion of delivery beyond, you know, the traditional walls of a hospital or, you know, physician office, which, you know, I think, as you said, can help with that ease of access and also, you know, I think the expansiveness of what can be offered.
Yeah, that's right. That's the right way to think about it, in my opinion. You know, it's access to healthcare, and access to healthcare is has to be cheaper when someone can take a test at home than if they have to go to a walk-in clinic or an emergency room. The cost associated with that is significantly higher than if a test can be conducted, you know, at home, or as a lot of people have probably done now, at even a drive-through facility in a parking lot somewhere. It's still a lower cost healthcare test than if it was administered in a physician setting or in a hospital setting. The other area I was going to mention when you asked, you know, what else has come from COVID, the second area really is the scale up, or the recognition for the need to scale up for the ability to produce tests like this on a larger scale. You know, COVID has, of course, necessitated that. There's a lot more capacity in the industry now. There's still not enough capacity to deliver on the promise of decentralized rapid testing on a global scale. But there's been significant investment in the infrastructure required to produce tests on a larger scale. And that's, you know, that's very important, obviously, for healthcare. And it's something that the industry has really needed for a long time as well, is that drive to be able to have more broad scale production on a global basis.
And having that broader scale production, does that also then kind of feed into the last point that we're talking about of the availability of at-home testing? Since theoretically, if people have access to that at home, maybe they're going to want, you know, maybe test more frequently, or
that's right,
test more broadly because they don't have to go somewhere, and maybe they'd be more willing to pay for it out of pocket if they have that option as well.
Yeah, that's right. And that's what I think the next step will be. That's really, I'd say, a quantum leap in terms of production capacity that would be needed to support, you know, again, I wouldn't say direct to consumer, you know, as you paused when you said that, but it's almost a direct to consumer model. It's much closer to a direct to consumer model than it probably is today. And that's either a physician orders, let's say, you know, four or five COVID tests to be taken daily for a week, much like you'd get with an antibiotics pack. You know, you get it in a packet and you take one a day, or, you know, so it's not direct to consumer, but it could actually be. I mean, there's certainly cases now where you can get sample collection kits on Amazon. It won't be long where it actually is direct to consumer. And that will require a significant capacity buildup in the manufacturing part of these tests. But it's an investment that I think companies will recognize they can get a return on. And that's been one of the major drawbacks in the industry in the past, is these rapid diagnostic tests have been viewed as low cost, and therefore the margins have been low and the reimbursement rates have been low. And so the desire to invest in scaling has been low from the industry perspective. That's also been turned on its head now as a result of COVID. And I think there's going to be some real advances in manufacturing capabilities as a result of the fact that people have made this renewed investment. So there are exciting changes in the industry that I think will bring better healthcare to the population of the world. And we should all be, you know, thankful. If there's anything to be thankful for in this COVID situation, it would be that better healthcare is coming, and we're not going to go back to the way healthcare was being conducted, you know, prior to COVID, which is great news for everybody.
Yeah, no, I think those are very fair points. And, you know, as you said, it's, you know, there has to be that kind of cost benefit analysis around it. And it's, you know, well, unfortunate, because you always want to think of healthcare and the drive of the industry being what's best for the individual. You know, kind of still at the end of the day, it's a business. And it's, you know, I feel like I've had this discussion with many people. It's, you know, because it's a business, you still have to make sure you can get make money or make smart investments, because otherwise, you know, you're not going to be around for the long haul. But believe it or not, we're actually already very close to the end of our time. So kind of picking up on the last point you made of one silver lining, would just like ask you for a concluding thought in terms of what do you think was the most unexpected benefit that's come out of the COVID pandemic?
I think it's related to this topic, and to me, the most unexpected and positive outcome is the recognition that testing, you know, at home is actually a viable alternative. And I think that's the benefit that will probably have the longest impact in post-COVID, is that change, that the ability, the recognition that testing at home is important, and once consumers have that option, they're going to not want to go back, because unlike physicians who might want to know whether you're actually sick or not, you know, individual people will be asking different questions. It's, you know, can my child go to school? I need to take a test. Can I go to the Super Bowl this weekend? I have a ticket. Can I go? Can I get on an airplane to travel? Very different questions that we'll be asking as consumers. And I think the ability to have those questions answered through this, you know, at-home testing process is going to be hugely important. And it's a great outcome.
Yeah, no, and I think a great thought to have is the parting idea to take away, because as I said, believe it or not, we are out of time. I want to thank my guest, Tony Lemo, for a great conversation today.
Yeah, thank you. I enjoyed it.
And thank you to everyone listening. Keep the dialogue going and connect with me at hashtag HCDEJURE. I'm Matt Fisher. Until next time.